support for this KQED podcast comes from ACT, presenting Stephen Sondheim's rapturous musical, A Little Night Music. Featuring an all-star cast, A Little Night Music begins performances at ACT's Geary Theater May 20th. ACT-SF.org.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this morning's forum program, over the weekend, the United States Senate voted not to renew controversial parts of the Patriot Act that allow government agencies to collect Americans' phone records. Those contentious parts are officially set to expire on May 31st, and now lawmakers are rushing to negotiate a deal before the NSA loses a big chunk of its surveillance authority. We discuss the likelihood of those changes making it through and what this means moving forward on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. Government agencies like the FBI have used the Patriot Act to justify collecting millions of Americans' phone records in the name of stopping terrorism. But over the weekend, the U.S. Senate voted not to renew the controversial parts of the Patriot Act that deal with surveillance. Now lawmakers are rushing to negotiate a new deal during their recess, one that would trim back the NSA's powers but also keep a good deal of its ability to collect data. We look at what lies ahead as talks continue before the May 31st deadline. And first, we go to Washington and welcome Ken Delanian, who is an intelligence reporter with the Associated Press and joins us from D.C. Good morning.
Good to be with you, Michael.
Glad to have you with us. Let's get an update on what's going on, particularly in light of what occurred over the Memorial Day weekend. Where do we stand?
Sure. Well, so this is obviously the most notorious and infamous program revealed by Edward Snowden, the former National Security Agency contractor. The NSA had been collecting metadata about Americans calling records, phone calls, mostly landlines, but to and from information, not content. And the House overwhelmingly passed a bill, Republicans and Democrats together, that would have stopped the NSA from doing that and changed that program. They would retain the capability to search the records, but the records would be held by the phone companies. That bill was backed by the president, by the intelligence agency directors, the FBI director, the attorney general. But that bill failed in the Senate over the weekend in the wee hours of Saturday morning by three votes. Senate Republicans, a cadre of Senate Republicans, not all, blocked that bill. They weren't satisfied with it. So now, but they were thinking that they could pass a short-term extension of the existing law. But that also failed. So now we're in a situation where all these authorities, including some non-controversial surveillance authorities that the FBI uses a lot to hunt for terrorists and spies, are going to expire May 31st, and the government is very concerned about that. So House Republicans are trying to cut a deal this week in negotiations with Senate leaders, make some tweaks, maybe offer something that the Senate can pass. But the House is in no mood to make any compromise. They feel like they've moved as far as they can move.
The two other surveillance authorities that are set to expire that you mentioned have to do with making it, I guess, easier to track lone wolf terrorist suspects and to act on behalf of many cell phones being suddenly discarded one after another?
Yeah, the so-called roving wiretap, that's the more commonly used one. And this doesn't implicate the criminal investigations, but in investigations of terrorism and national security and espionage, they want the ability to get a warrant to track a person rather than a device for people who are constantly discarding their cell phones. And they use this commonly, and they would lose this on May 31st at midnight.
And what about the USA Freedom Act? Where does that figure in here?
Well, so that's the bill that the House passed and that failed by three votes. It failed to reach 60 votes. So it got a majority in the Senate, but it fell three votes short of 60. That is the bill that everyone except a handful of Senate Republicans support and thinks would be sort of a reasonable reform. You know, it would get the NSA out of the business of storing Americans' calling records, which disturbs a lot of people because there's a lot of private information in there. But it would still allow them to take known terrorist phone numbers and search the calling records of Americans to see if there's any contacts, you know, between an international terrorism plot and people in the United States. They would do that by sending the number out to the phone companies. So that's, I mean, right now, House leaders who've passed this bill are negotiating with Senate leaders to see if there's anything they can do to get 3 more votes in the Senate. And the Senate is coming back into session May 31st. And so if they pass some version that's acceptable to the House, they'll send that bill back to the House. The House will pass it. It'll become law. That's the scenario that people are hoping for at the moment.
We're talking to Ken Delanian, who is an intelligence reporter for the Associated Press. So give us a picture of all the politics and brinksmanship that's going on here, and particularly maybe you might shed some light on the 10 and a half hours that Rand Paul ran his mouth.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, Rand Paul has gotten a lot of attention. Rand Paul, though, actually is not crucial to this debate. With or without Rand Paul, the thing still would have, you know, USA Freedom was still three votes short, because Rand Paul wants the entire Patriot Act to expire. He's like sort of on the extreme libertarian fringe. His position is it all should go away. But what's also interesting is there's a group of libertarian Republicans who support the USA Freedom Act and who have broken with their leadership on this. And you certainly saw that in the House. I mean, the people who voted against the bill in the House wanted it to go farther, actually. And they wanted to do other reforms of things that aren't related to this, like the PRISM program, where the NSA is searching actual content and inadvertently getting American content. So you got a real schism in the Republican Party here. The Democrats are fairly unified in support of the USA Freedom Act, and the president supports it. But it's really the Republicans where are having the issue over it.
Any predictions at this point?
I think they're going to get something done, because nobody wants to see this thing completely expire. So I just have a feeling the Senate R's are going to have to back down and pass something that the House can accept. But who knows at this point? I mean, nobody would have predicted what happened last weekend.
Ken Delanian, again, intelligence reporter, Associated Press. Ken, appreciate so much you being with us. Thank you.
Michael, thanks for having me.
And let me tell you who else we're going to have for the rest of the hour. David Green's here in studio with us. He's Civil Liberties Director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Michael.
Glad to have you. We also have Charles Cully Simpson with us. And Charles Cully Simpson is manager of the National Security Law Program and senior legal fellow with the Heritage Foundation. He's also a former Deputy Assistant Defense Secretary for Detainee Affairs. And welcome to the program, Charles Simpson.
Thanks, Michael. Call me Cully.
Cully, it will be. And let me begin, Cully, by asking you, I mean, from your perspective, the Patriot Act presumably should be kept pretty much intact in terms of security and what the law is going to have by way of tools and more tools.
Well, I appreciate Ken Delanian's overview of the political theatrics involved here. And, of course, what we're talking about is not the entire Patriot Act, but particularly Section 215 and the authorities they're under, or at least the authorities the government claims it has the power to use they're under. And so we're only dealing with 215. And we at Heritage published a paper late last week laying out 3 viable scenarios for the use of Section 215. And one of those is indeed the USA Freedom Act. And we make the point that, you know, there have been at least 68 known plots thwarted since 9/11 in the United States. We don't know in particular how many of those plots and how many unknown plots there are that Section 215, the telephone metadata program, was used to either completely solve it or used a smidgen of it to solve it. But we do know that in a recent report from a few years ago, when you combine Section 215 and another section called 702, that helped foil or lead to the foiling of several of these plots. And so we believe that—
Excuse me, I just want for the record, pardon me, Cully, but 702 has to do with Foreign Intelligence Surveillance
Correct.
Act.
Correct, yeah. Yeah, thank you for that. I should not go into bureau speak here. And so we believe that that reform is necessary— number one, but that we should have some capability that's transparent enough but effective enough so that we don't leave a tool on the table that has been proven somewhat useful.
Well, I'd like to hear what you mean by reform, but let me go to David Green first here. Do we know if 215 has ever stopped a terrorist attack domestically, David Green?
Well, what we know from the There's two groups that have really looked very – two independent groups have looked very closely at Section 215. The president had an advisory group that was convened to look at it, and there was also a group called the PCLOB, which is the President's Civil Liberties Oversight Board. And both of these groups looked at it and had access to classified information, and their conclusion was that Section 215 itself was really only useful in one situation. This was a prosecution of a gentleman in San Diego who was ultimately convicted of sending $8,500 to the El Shabaab group. And other than that, Section 215 itself has not, at least it hasn't been shown to those groups or otherwise to have been effective. Now, Section 702 has seemed to be the section, that the authority that really has been used to stop the other terrorist attacks or contribute to identifying the other terrorist threats that when this number, the 6-8 number, gets bandied about.
Well, let me cut to the chase here because although I know you have great concerns about privacy, this metadata allows essentially the government to have intimate and personal data on all of us, at least theoretically. But the big argument that seems to fall on the side of perhaps reform, we'll hear from what Cully Stimson has to say about that, but keeping things somewhat intact is security, that we're in more need of as much security as we possibly can foster now.
Yeah, well, I'm not against security in any way, but
let me reframe that. The metadata gives us more accessibility and more protection vis-a-vis security.
I think there's two questions. One, you could say if this program were efficacious, then we could have a really good discussion about what the proper balance is between civil liberties and privacy rights and addressing national security concerns. But this program has not been shown to be efficacious, or at least is very minimally efficacious. And I think that tips the balance way in favor of the privacy concerns. And that's why I think really significant reform that goes well beyond USA freedom is what's really needed.
And you say, what about that balance? Or imbalance, Cully Stimson?
Well, what I say is what I wrote a few years ago in a Understanding America series that we had here at Heritage, where I trace the back to our founders' time, and you know, we always hear talk about having this balance between privacy and security, and I think really we're looking at it the wrong way. I think, and what I argued in the paper is we should maximize both to the extent practicable, depending on the times. And so that's why I think now is the time to enact meaningful reforms to Section 215, but keep the core capability of it, because this canard that, you know, well, Section 215 has only resulted in foiling one terrorist plot, I think is a red herring. That's not the way intelligence works. It's not the way evidence works in criminal cases. I was a former federal prosecutor. One little strand of evidence might not necessarily result in the taking down of the defendant in a criminal case or a terrorist in a terrorist plot, but it may lead to other things which ultimately help in the conviction and or foiling of a plot. And that's why these little pieces of a broader mosaic are important to keep as capabilities.
And what is the nature of how you would reform 215, or what you would do to make it at least more protective vis-a-vis privacy?
Yeah. Well, first off, I think putting into statute, instead of allowing the government, which the Obama administration, as you know, has taken certain key reforms, for example, you know, going from 3 hops down to 2 hops, for example, having the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, the FISC, deciding reasonable articulable suspicion in terms of the applications for search inquiries. Putting that into a statute is better than leaving it to any administration to decide if on the whim that they can go back up to 3 hops or unlimited hops, or deciding their own reasonable articulable suspicion. Having FISC orders, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court orders, be more transparent. In other words, having a presumption of releasability unless, you know, there's a very narrow window in which you can't release it. I don't have a particular problem, nor do we at Heritage have a particular problem with an advocate before the FISC, and that's part of the USA Freedom Act. So I think there are a number of other ones which we could go into in detail if you want that I think are helpful, and it gives the public more confidence that the government is not overreaching or has the capability of overreaching into their business and their Fourth Amendment rights.
We should mention here that California Senator Dianne Feinstein actually has argued in favor of retaining this data. as a requirement for phone companies. But David Green, where do you come down, particularly in the context of reform?
Well, I'm a big proponent of reform. And
so you want to go a lot farther than Cully here.
Yeah, well, I know. I think that both the two options that seem to be realistically on the table right now are the House USA Freedom bill or just the sunsetting of Section 215. And I think either one of those options are incomplete reform. I think that USA Freedom is a start to reform. I agree with everything Cully said that the reforms in it are certainly needed. I just think we need to go beyond them and reform dragnet mass surveillance beyond Section 215 into some of the other programs under which it's authorized or at least purportedly authorized as well. I agree that the FISC, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, needs significant transparency imposed upon it. And I think USA Freedom starts there, but I would like to see that there'd be an independent advocate in every case, not just on the cases where the court requests it. I think there should be greater transparency required of the court in terms of what opinions it publishes. So I believe that there should be reforms beyond that.
And your reaction to the kind of reforms beyond that that David Green is suggesting here, Cully Stimson?
Well, I think what he's really talking about is simply ending the program. So there's reform means working with the existing capabilities and adding additional protections against the government's intrusion into our Fourth Amendment rights. I mean, for example, the USA Freedom Act, as it currently exists, has pen register, trap and trace device reform. It bans bulk collection of that. I've written about national security letters, and the USA Freedom Act in particular has a major reform to the National Security Letter program. It ends the bulk collection of that. And so, I mean, these are major, major reforms, which frankly will take many, many months, if not longer, if passed, to institute them across the government. So I think, there's a difference between reform in practice and reform in word only when you're actually killing. And I think I would respectfully disagree with Ken. I mean, I'm sorry, David, because I think what David's really talking about and what their website talks about is just simply letting the program expire, which is not reform.
Let me talk about that with you for a minute, David Green, because if you let the program expire, there are those like the FBI director who say that this would be a grievous mistake, that we need this program now more than ever. There are also those who argue, I'm talking again about the balance between security and privacy, that what Charlie Hebdo showed us is, again, the need for security, that we don't have enough control over passports like they do in the UK. In other words, you hear all these arguments kind of marshaled to say we need to keep things intact.
Well, yeah, I think Section 215 does a lot more than just authorize telephone call records collection. Mm-hmm. And its business records provision goes beyond telephone call records collection. So I do imagine that if Section 215 expires, there will be some efforts to reintroduce some portions of Section 215 as additional legislation. But then at least you get debate about the merits of individual provisions, and you have an open process where the government, where Congress looks at individual provisions and decides on their merits which ones should be enacted back into law, and to what extent they should be enacted back into law. And so I understand that's something that will happen if Section 215 expires. I do believe that mass bulk surveillance of people who are not suspected of having done anything wrong, which is what we get with the call detail records collection, and the other types of bulk surveillance that are performed under other authorities, I do believe that should end. I believe it violates the Fourth Amendment. I believe it violates the First Amendment, and I believe it should end.
What about those constitutional arguments, Cully Stimson, particularly in terms of just civil liberties and essentially finding out everything from the government's point of view about private lives?
Yeah, and that's where you see this sort of odd bedfellows, if you could call it that, between conservatives, libertarians, and liberals. All three of those groups have deep skepticism about the government in terms of its ability to know everything we're doing. We are privacy hawks, to use coin a term, and that's why you see these odd divisions of folks, especially in the Republican caucus, splitting up in terms of their votes on this. But yeah, I mean, look, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in the middle of May on the relevancy aspect of the Section 215 program. They didn't touch the constitutionality, but as David pointed out, and I think as you pointed out, Michael, there was a decision in San Diego called the Mualin case, is a criminal case, that held that the bulk telephony metadata collection does not violate the Fourth Amendment. At the same time, Judge Leon, in the same year, 2013, here in the D.C. District Court, he held that it did violate the Fourth Amendment, and that case is on appeal. The D.C. Circuit, which is the second highest court in the land, has yet to rule on that. So I think it's an open debate as to whether this violates the Fourth Amendment. The Second Circuit opinion is a very well-reasoned opinion, and that's why Mitch McConnell, Senator Mitch McConnell's simple extension ploy was never going to go anywhere, because it doesn't address the Second Circuit's opinion, which is that that the program went beyond the statute. So I think we've been having this debate for, you know, since 9/11, and if it expires, we'll continue to have this debate. And it's a healthy debate. It's actually a strength of our country that we can have this debate.
What about the notion that a 2-month extension would be appropriate, given the fact that so much to sort out here?
You know, you mentioned my bio. I was for a couple years head of the Taney policy in the second half of the Bush administration. And what I think I learned from that is when you ignore a court opinion or you do something at the edges of a court opinion, and here I'm particularly talking about the Hamdan decision, which came down in 2006 saying that the president needed express authorization from Congress to set up a military commission. Here, if the Senate simply and the House agreed for some reason, and they won't, to extend this Section 215 for 2 months, I think it puts the whole program at litigation risk, even more risk than it already is in. I don't think it's wise. It flies in the face of the Second Circuit. I think we should be learning the lessons, especially the lessons from adverse court decisions or favorable court decisions, depending on your point of view, since 9/11.
Let me have you weigh in here, David Green.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's, I think, a reauthorization, I think it's unnecessary. I think it's irresponsible. Of it's not good government. You know, the House, this issue that this expiration date was coming up, the Senate had plenty of time to debate this. I think the only reason you even let it get close to expiration is to try and influence the debate in some way and to actually kill significant reform. And I don't think they need another 2 months. There's a bill in front of them that passed that was overwhelmingly supported in the House by both parties. So I don't think you need 2 months an extension. Again, I agree. The Second Circuit said the law doesn't authorize what you want it to do. And so I agree it's not needed. It's unnecessary.
And the Patriot Act extension did fail to pass the Senate. I'd like to invite those of you listening to join this conversation. And I know there's some strong sentiments about the Patriot Act, about its expiring or about need for reform or what you'd like to see or what you'd like not to see. Our toll-free number is available to you now, and we invite you to join the program. That number, 866-733-6786. You can join us now, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. The number to call, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, or go to our Facebook page. Talking with David Green, Civil Liberties Director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and Charles Kelly Stimson, who is manager of the National Security Law Program and senior legal fellow with the Heritage Foundation. Feel free to join us. We'll hear from you when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Over the weekend, the U.S. Senate voted not to renew controversial parts of the Patriot Act that allow government agencies to collect Americans' phone records. Those contentious parts are officially set to expire on the 31st of May, and now lawmakers are rushing to negotiate a deal before the NSA loses a big chunk of its surveillance authority. And we're discussing the likelihood of changes making it through and what this means moving forward. With us in studio is David Green, who is Civil Liberties Director for the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And with us by phone is Cully Stimson, Manager of the National Security Law Program and Senior Legal Fellow with the Heritage Foundation. He's also former Deputy Assistant Defense Secretary for Detainees Affairs. And we do welcome your involvement in the program. You can join the conversation with questions or comments by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going right to our website, kqed.org/forum. Let me read a couple of comments on the website. A listener writes, the FBI can claim all they want that surveillance works. They have a vested interest in claiming surveillance works. Since when are the people who brought us COINTELPRO and surveillance of protesters the source of truth about everything? About anything. And here's a listener in Emmanuel who says, we must pardon Snowden. Without his stand, the Patriot Act would have been renewed. Yet again, we must acknowledge his role. Mr. Obama, pardon Snowden. What about Snowden's role in all this? Cully Stimson, you want to opine on that?
I have two thoughts on that, Michael. One is you don't pardon people till they've been convicted, usually. You can, I guess, issue him some sort of legal protection, but typically you bring people to justice. They get convicted, and either at the sentencing, the assistant U.S. attorney would make an argument towards mitigation, which would typically come from the defense counsel, or you get convicted, you get sentenced, and then near the end of the president's term, you would issue a pardon of some sort. One thing that Snowden has done, which was of course one of his main driving motivations, is to spur and drive this discussion around the United States and indeed the world, and he has certainly done that. And people have very strong feelings about him. I mean, I see stuff on our website. He's a traitor. He should be shot. He should be blah blah blah. And people on the other side, he's a hero. He has, you know, terrific for doing this. More people should do this. And you see everything in between. And I think, just staying in my lane as a lawyer, he is. Broken clearly some laws with respect to what he was required to keep secret, and so at the very least, in terms of incentives, we need to bring him. He needs to be held to account to that. What happens in terms of a sentence, et cetera, is certainly up to this president or the next.
Well, we've certainly had a lot of discussion on this program about Ed Snowden. David Green, let's hear from you on this.
Yeah, I mean, I think very simply, we're in a much better place today than we were before we knew what he before we knew about the programs that his documents disclosed. You might recall that the telephone records program was first reported on back in 2006 by USA Today, and just the mere reporting on it without documentation really didn't spur the debate that we are having now. So it really was necessary for Congress to take action, for the public to have this debate, for this really cross-political spectrum of people to come together in opposition of these programs. That wouldn't have happened without Snowden's actions. So whether that means that it's the government should grant him some type of immunity from prosecution or otherwise, grant him some type of leniency, I think that's a question we can talk about. But I think the important thing is that we are all better off now than we were before.
All right. Let's find out what our public has to say. And join us, Frank. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'd like to point out that there's a technical solution to the legal issues that are being discussed, and Mr. Simpson probably has personal knowledge of it, and that is there was an Espionage Act prosecution of an NSA staffer about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, that concluded, and among the other things reported was that the NSA had developed, just at the time these programs were putting in, a way of stripping out all the personal data that is causing this trouble and nevertheless maintaining the connection, the metadata connection pieces they wanted. And the Cheney team said, don't bother, we're going to do it the way, we're going to take it all in defiance of the then existing law. I'm wondering whether Mr. Simpson or Mr. Green have read any of that material and thinks that that might be a partial solution.
All right, let's hear first from you, David Green, on this.
Yeah, I am familiar with that. I don't think, as far as I know, that did not apply to the call records program that we're talking about. I believe that applied to the collection under the PRISM or upstream program, which are internet collection programs. Again, I think it really comes down to how you define personalized information. The information is not valuable unless it can be linked to an individual. But I do believe what we like to talk about these things in terms of minimization procedures, what you do with the data once it is collected, and and how it's retained. And one of the things, the reform measures that are being talked about are requiring minimization procedures, and there are some of those in USA Freedom, or what has also been called super minimization procedures, which were in some of the earlier versions of the reform bills.
Yeah. Colley Simpson?
Yeah, to Frank's question, I've never been read into the classified programs related to the telephone metadata program. But what I have read publicly, and I think this is related to his question, is what happens in those cases, and we're starting to see some now, where intelligence agencies collect information either through 215 or 702 or some other bulk collection program. They provide that ultimately to the prosecutor. The prosecutor, not knowing the origin, sees it as sort of vanilla evidence that he can use in his case in chief, uses that, the person gets convicted, and the defense attorney, the prosecutor, and the judge doesn't know the origin from which it came and that it wasn't subject to a court order. And we're starting to see some of those cases now, and I think you're going to start seeing more and more of those cases. And it's a good question, and it flows from what I think is breaching or potentially breaching this wall between collecting intelligence for intelligence purposes only, or collecting intelligence and then with full disclosure giving it to criminal prosecutors who can then use that with full disclosure to the defense of how they got it.
Let me bring another caller on. Dan, join us. You're on.
Hi, yes. My question is kind of twofold. The first is the current, you know, as a law-abiding citizen, with the program as it stands, what privacy do I really stand to lose? And then I guess my second one is, you guys just touched on briefly, but are there any realistic examples of somebody that didn't commit a crime that maybe had a skeleton exposed out of their closet by this and actually ended up harming them?
The first question that Dan raises here, David Green, is one that often comes up. You know, we're law-abiding citizens. What do we have to fear in terms of our privacy supposedly being abridged? And I think the second question sort of dovetails on that.
Yeah, well, I think, Dan, unless you don't have your telephone service through a major carrier, what you know is that the government has a record of every call that you've made, every call that you've received, how long those calls have lasted. I think many people find that to be an invasion of their privacy, that they don't believe their relationship with the government permits the government to have and retain that amount of information about them. Again, and we're just talking about one program there. You could say the same thing about your internet behavior that's collected under different programs. Every time the government queries this database, your information is queried, is run through to see if you have connections. You've either called the same number as someone who's being investigated, or you've called the same number or received a call from someone the next layer up, from someone who's being investigated. So that's how your privacy is being, your call records are being used as part of investigations.
Let me follow up Dan's question with an email here, and I'll go to you on this again, David Green. Then I want to go to Colley Simpson with another email. This email listener, Carl, writes, "Those against Patriot Act provisions are an extreme libertarian lunatic fringe. Well, it just failed Congress, Freedom Act or not, and it was already on a short expiration for a reason. Many of the points stated here are deeply questionable, even going off commonly accepted stuff. I've heard from many sources the 215 phone data has not been useful, and unnamed terrorist attacks should be discarded as unfounded nonsense unless strong evidence can be given at this point. This discussion needs some serious balance."
Yeah, I think that – I mean, I agree with that. And as far – you know, I don't have access to classified information, but the groups that have had access to classified information has found that this program has not been that helpful. And if you talk to experts, to people who are data analysis, they'll tell you that having more data doesn't help you find information.
And Colley Simpson, you kind of alluded to this before, but Bill sends us the following email. Can somebody please articulate the core of the argument for why these programs don't violate the Fourth Amendment? Apparently there's an argument, but it's a huge mystery to most Americans.
Sure. Let me work in reverse order and start with Bill's email. The Supreme Court has held in Smith against Maryland and subsequent cases that data owned by third parties, telephone providers, is not the data of you and me who work with and are customers of Verizon, Sprint, AT&T, et cetera. And so even though we consider it private, it's in the hands of a third party and not any different than if you took a Coke can, picked it up in your hand, had your DNA on it, and then threw the Coke can away. It's in your garbage can outside your house. It is in a third party. Now the garbage vendor or the phone call example, the business record of the third party. And so the Fourth Amendment protects the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, what does it say, papers and effects against unreasonable government searches and seizures. And so this is a voluntary transaction between you and a third-party provider who keeps business records of those particular calls. So that's the argument and answer to Bill's question. To Dan's question, what privacy do I lose? It's important to distinguish between Fourth Amendment protected private Fourth Amendment protected information and the lesser, but just I think equally important to a lot of people, privacy interests. I don't want anyone seeing my medical records. I don't want, even though my doctor's office holds it, I don't want anyone seeing how many fillings I've had and braces that I had when I was a kid at my orthodontist. I don't want people seeing my telephone calls. No one really does.
I don't care if anyone learns about my fillings, but that's just me, maybe.
Well, I've enriched the dental profession immensely over the years. I can say
I think of a lot of things a lot more private than your
teeth.
Yeah,
but I mean, I think David and I would agree a lot in the sense that these body, this body of information we're talking about, dental, medical, phone, all the rest of it, there are critical privacy interests we have in it. The question for the courts is whether it's protected by the Fourth Amendment. And this is where Smith and other cases that flowed from Smith against Maryland have held that at least in terms of the telephone metadata, is not protected by the Fourth Amendment. The Mualin case from San Diego held that it was not protected by the Fourth Amendment. But then there's Judge Leon's decision that says it is violative of the Fourth Amendment. So there is a vital, vibrant debate in the legal academy on this.
All right. We can perhaps hear what David Green has to say on this. But first, I want to bring another caller named David from Virginia onto the air here. David, you're on.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. First of all, I'd like to say that this is an interesting debate that occurs here right after Memorial Day. And I had the privilege to spend 24 months in Afghanistan in 2013 and 2014 working primarily in a counter-IED effort, and I consider much of this debate to be relevant to that experience and that effort. I would like to know how the legal implications and the constitutionality of the things that we're talking about compare with private data collection, private data storage, and intrusion on people's privacy to further their interests. Why isn't this part of the same debate? Because it's essentially the same technologies in many cases. That's one question that I have is does anybody ever compare the two, and are they related from a legal point of view at the legislature level? And the second question that I have is I hear Mr. Green and Mr. Simpson very intelligently articulating the pros and cons of intrusions of privacy. Who qualifies or quantifies the constituency's point of view? I hear often the senator's point of view is this, or the congressman's point of view is this. But are we really having a debate about whether or not Americans are comfortable with an intrusion of privacy in the interest of national security? And do we really query our constituency and bring that into the debate in a quantifiable way?
All right, both solid, salient questions. David Green, let's begin with, and you might want to address the constitutionality again of the Fourth Amendment here and how it applies. But with his first question, I mean, you got private companies collecting metadata through web browsing, right?
Yes, yeah, you certainly do. And now the constitutional restrictions, the Fourth Amendment, the First Amendment, perhaps the Fifth Amendment, though they restrict the government, they don't restrict private corporations unless they're acting as agents of the government. But I don't think that's the situation the caller is talking about here. So we do need to find a different solution to those concerns. And we think the most effective one there really is transparency, is that for consumers who are using the services to be able to make choices, they need to understand how their information is being used and exploited by corporations, and then they can choose to use that or not. If there is going to be a governmental solution, it will have to be a legislative solution, and the legislature will have to balance competing interests, and there are many efforts, and there are laws that do this, that restrict the ability of private entities that collect information to disseminate that information, and those laws tend to vary according to the specific information. So we have laws that deal with medical information. We have laws that deal with financial information. We have laws that deal with educational records. And those are just a few examples.
Well, when he also calls attention to the fact that the House and the Senate don't necessarily do massive polling of how people feel about their privacy, I mean, this is a representative democracy, and that's part of the limitation of that. We can't necessarily know what a great majority of citizens are feeling along these lines, and polls not necessarily all that accurate anyway. So that's a metric that in some respects remains maybe in suspended animation.
Sure, it's hard to quantify those things precisely, but there have been some fairly comprehensive studies that have shown that the majority of Americans do fall on the privacy side of this debate. The Pew Foundation has done several studies. One just came out very recently that showed, I believe, in the upwards of 70% of Americans were on the privacy side of this balance, felt that the bulk collection of their communications did infringe on their privacy rights. And then also it's measured by, what we at EFF do is we really, encourage people to make their opinions known to the representatives. What I've heard, there was actually a lot of calls to Congress people, I imagine on both sides of the debate, urging their representatives to vote one way or the other on these reforms.
Kelly Stimson.
David, thank you for your service. 24 months in Afghanistan is a long hitch. I served 23 years in the Navy, and thank you for that. I'll address the second question because I agree 100% with David Green's answer to the first part, government versus a private industry. Who quantifies the constituency point of view? The difference between our elected representatives and us is some of them sit on committees of jurisdiction and have the opportunity to attend and actually listen to briefings of a classified nature and get the raw data on how efficacious these programs are. Now, I will say, having been in the government and having given classified briefings, not all members of this House and Senate are necessarily paying attention or want to even be at some of those classified briefings because they prefer not to hear it, which is, I think, a dereliction of duty in my humble opinion. But they do have the access to that information. And so, when Ron Wyden, the senator from Oregon, hears one thing and Senator Tom Cotton from Oklahoma hears the same thing, they may come out of that classified briefing with two wholly different interpretations. And again, I think that's the strength of our democracy, and that's why we need to have these types of debates.
Well, let me bring another caller on. And Arne, that's you. Good morning.
Hi, this is Arne. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, go ahead.
All right. Just to bring this up to a larger level, I'm staying with Daniel Ellsberg right now, and he's working on a book about nuclear planning over the last 40 years, and we've been in many discussions about this topic and others. And one of the things that's come to light is that the Obama administration is actually prosecuting more whistleblowers than any other president in the history. So when you weigh out the benefits of, does this type of surveillance help make America safer, or is this type of surveillance creating greater problems for us in terms of our liberties and freedoms? I'd be interested in knowing what the two speakers have
well,
to
I
say
think
on
we've,
that.
Well, I think we've had them outline their positions here, and this is at the heart of the debate. In fact, it's getting a lot of responses via email here. Rick writes, this morning's discussion about the NSA reminds me of my concerns about every website asking me to log in. Facebook, Google, Apple all want me to log in at the beginning. I'm a well-aged man dating from the days of black and white movies with classical music in the background, and this trend is worrisome, to say the least. I believe that we all want security, but at what cost? Maybe we need more strength and courage. Richard writes, the height of absurdity here is that there were 57 votes in favor of the compromise. I oppose the Patriot Act, but I don't like the idea that without a real filibuster, the opponents were able to stop the extension of the bill. This highlights how dysfunctional the Congress is. And another listener named Richard says, get this right, the Senate did not vote. It failed to get enough votes to pass on legislation. Thank you for that. Andrew says, yes, phone calls are a big deal, but in this day and age, are phone calls really the thing that we should be focusing on? It seems to me this is a redirection from other more serious collection of electronic communication like email, text, and data flowing through applications like WhatsApp and Twitter. Is this being addressed in the current discussion in D.C.? And Kirk writes from Oregon about Snowden's pardon. President Ford pardoned Nixon without a prior conviction. Daily Beast says it's a win for NSA to give record-keeping to telcos. They would be able to ask FISA court for more mobile phones, not just landlines, address information, et cetera. And so it goes. We are, of course, going to get to more of your phone calls here. But first, I want to remind you that you are listening to Forum and that we are talking to David Green and Cully Stimson, and that this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to a caller in Dublin. Mark, you're on. Good morning.
Hi, thanks. Just really speaking to the transparency of this whole matter. You know, nobody would be talking about this if it wasn't for the illegal actions of a contractor, Mr. Snowden, who basically gave up his life, as he knew it, to bring this to our attention. No one would be talking about this. So the argument that there could be any transparency in government through a Republican president and a Democratic president and our own representative supporting it in Congress is specious. Thanks. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Well, that's an editorial comment, but you want to respond first? Cully Stimson?
I agree to the extent that our government has a growing and pernicious tendency of overclassifying stuff. In fact, I hosted a panel here a couple years ago at Heritage on just that. And in fact, when you sit at a computer in a high-level government job and you have access to classified information, some of the default settings are classified when you send an email. And so that's a problem. People didn't really pay attention when we had the debate in 2008 about the FISA Amendments Act, although a lot of the discussion was here in Washington, people paid attention. But I think the caller is right to the extent that Snowden definitely turbocharged the discussion.
David Green.
Yeah, I agree. I think I think there's many aspects of government which are not transparent enough, and I think this is a great example of a system which essentially failed, even failed to the members of the congressmen and women who actually passed the original law because of a lack of transparency.
Here's a sobering email from a listener named Richard who says, does anyone really believe that on June 1st the government will stop collecting this data? And another from Bradley who says, well, we will continue to explore and discuss the specifics of the law and the Patriot Act. It seems essential that we review, discuss, reform the larger national behaviors that bred the hatred and contempt for all things USA, which sparked acts of terrorism and therefore the apparent need for the Patriot Act in the first place. What path do your guests see for progress at correcting the casualties of all the base problems of jihadi anti-USA terrorism? IMO, that will be the only way to really solve all the Patriot Act problems. I don't know if either of you want to respond to that, but let me move on here to a listener who's pro-surveillance, who says, generally tickets aren't issued for being 5 or even 10 miles over the speed limit in non-congested freeways. It's likely that all of us have conversations, emails, etc., that may be embarrassing in the event of public exposure, but so what? I prefer that the NSA, the FBI, or any federal agency monitoring all communication for national safety. I doubt that 99.99% of things that may be personally embarrassing are what the government is searching for. Lots of people weighing in here, and let's hear from another listener. Wynn, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. I have strictly an economic question. How is it that Congress can debate so much about a program spending billions and billions of dollars in which they cannot demonstrate any lives saved in the United States, and we can't get anybody to consider the highway safety program where well over 50,000 people are killed every year, and we're not even renewing what's going on there?
That's a reasonably thoughtful point. Kelly Simpson?
This is the sort of Richard Posner B equals P times L question. The burden of any particular action equals the probability times the loss. And I think I don't know what the program costs per se. I doubt it costs billions and billions, but he could be right and I could be wrong. I just don't know.
More like millions and millions, yeah.
Yeah, and I think the answer they would give you, and I've heard from folks, is something like this. Having all lawful tools on the table helps them connect the dots. And any catastrophic mistake that results in a nuclear, biological, or radiological bomb going off in the United States would make those highway traffic numbers look like nothing.
Final word from you on this, David Green.
Well, I agree that there is some cost benefit analysis, and unfortunately, we just really don't. The public doesn't have the information to make that assessment. I again go back to the two independent agencies that made the assessment that the program wasn't worth it, and that's really why both the administration and the intelligence community are supporting reforms in the situation. I mean, certainly you could say that in a totalitarian state, and I just at the extreme, where the government knows everything you do, that there would be fewer threats to you, but I don't think anybody wants that. So we need to draw the line somewhere else, and I think it should be drawn very far from that point.
Well, we'll let it stand there because we come to the end of the program, but you can continue this discussion online by going to kqed.org. We invite you to do that, and we also invite you to another hour of forum coming up. Mark Bittman, New York Times food writer, will be joining us in the hour ahead, so we're obviously shifting gears rather dramatically as we do from time to time, but we want to remind you that we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening, and I want to thank David Green, who's here with us in studio, Civil Liberties Director for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Thank you, David.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael.
And thank you, Kelly Stimson, who is with us by phone from Washington, D.C., manager of the National Security Law Program and senior legal fellow with the Heritage Foundation. Thank you, Kelly.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you, our listeners, because we wouldn't be here without you. And as I said, we are here with you every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum. It features Mark Bittman. We're not only going to talk about food and what he sees as the rather messed up food system. We're going to talk about some things that he really loves here, like the California produce, and we'll fill you in maybe even on some good recipes. So a lighter hour ahead. But as I said, you can continue this discussion online, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.